just turning the car on doesn't mean it's going to go anywhere. You have to shift it. You know, you can have a car full of gas and it won't go anyplace. So you have to have all these things work together. And that's an important thing, because there's very few parts of the West where you will get these conditions all in the same place at the same time. But when you do, look out.
And that's it for this episode of Coast Range Radio. Stay tuned for part two of George's talk, or listen to the entire talk by searching for Coast Range Radio on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or any other podcast app. Huge thanks to Silas, Karen, and Jennifer with the Stop Clear Cutting CA team from the Sierra Club for putting on the Forest Protection Forum series. You can find all of their webinars, including a great talk from our very own Chuck Willer, just by searching Stop Clear Cutting CA, as in California. Or you can find links to that and more in the show notes of our podcast feed. Thanks so much for listening. My email is michael@coastrange.org, and we'll be back with part two in a couple weeks.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
We know a KBOO community membership is at the top of everyone's wish list this season. Give the gift of supporting grassroots community media by making a donation during KBOO's Catalog of Connections campaign now through December 31st. Our $75,000 goal will go towards everyone's favorite music, news, and public affairs programming all year long. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Thank you and happy holidays.
Do you like discovering new music and reconnecting with some older but perhaps forgotten favorites? Then look no further. Tune into The Listening Room with host Timothy P. every other Thursday at 3 in the morning for a genre-bending 2.5-hour show where you never know what you might hear next, but you will be sure to be engaged and entertained.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up. It's Labor Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio. Of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, here with co-host Rachel Haynes. Hey, Rachel.
Hey, Stephen.
Hey, we are broadcasting around the world from Portland, Oregon. Both of us are public school teachers, and we host every second Monday of the month where we typically interview educators and talk about what's going on in their schools and in their unions. And joining us today, we have Mariana Fisher and Sandy Washburn. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, excited to have you with us. Let's start by just having you introduce yourselves, what you do, as an educator, where you work, how long you've been an educator.
Okay. Well, like you said, Stephen, my name is Mariana Fisher. I am the bilingual elementary school counselor at South Shore Elementary. This is my fourth year there and my fourth year as a school counselor. Previous to that, I was a behavior specialist in the Corvallis School District, which is what led me to want to be in counseling.
Nice.
And I'm Sandy Washburn. I am in my 23rd year here in Albany. I've held a lot of different roles, but basically overall, I'm a behavior specialist and wellness advocate. So I'm housed out of the special programs office.
Gotcha. Great. And what inspired both of you to go into education? We always like to ask our guests what inspired them.
I would say for me, I just honestly enjoy working with kids. That was something that even as a teenager, I went to Corvallis High School and they have a preschool program. It's their child development class, and you get to create lessons and work with your peers in a group, much like partner teachers do at a grade level, and you get to teach. And it was just so fun. And I enjoyed that it was very dynamic. It didn't look the same every week. And so it was just fun and interesting and always changing. And so that was my first kind of step into what education could look like. And so I wanted to be a teacher at first, but then realized my skill set lies more in counseling. And so that's kind of what took me in that direction.
That's funny. All of those personality tests you take in school always said teacher, kindergarten teacher for me as well. But I did not want to do that. So I came from more of a mental health perspective and then worked in residential down in California doing my graduate work and taught there on an emergency license and then came back home and just have come in through more of the mental health piece.
Yeah.
And seeing how that just felt like rather than being a counselor to hit one kid at a time, reach one kid at a time, that I could get into schools and do broader work. So I've always been in the high needs classroom programs.
Great. And what about in your unions? Do you hold any positions, either elected or just what do you do in your union?
Yeah, absolutely. I am one of the building reps for my building as well as the area rep. So I support four buildings, including my own, as an area rep.
Yeah, and I'm also new to the game all this time in the district, but this was my first year jumping in because nobody was filling in for special programs as a whole. So I was like, I'll do this. Picked a good year.
So we invited you on the show to hear about your historic strike. Yay! But first, would you tell us about the Albany community and the families that live there?
Albany's really a great little small community. It's a great place to raise families, a lot of new families. We're right next door to Corvallis, which is more of the university and hospital town. So affordability and things, we all come over to Albany. And the schools have historically been strong. There's a lot of them and small, very much union driven with the industries and the work that are here. So, it's just a nice, small, a lot of community events and things that bring people together.
Mm-hmm. And what were the greatest needs that you're trying to address in your contract? And how did you decide what your bargaining priorities would be?
Yeah, well, I would say the biggest needs, what everything sort of boiled down to was safety. So I know we'll discuss it more, but several of our articles were safety driven and wanting to make the classroom and the educational settings more safe for students by looking at smaller class sizes, but also in having accountability for how buildings, building admin, district support staff respond to really big behaviors, because those systems were already in place. There just wasn't a lot of accountability on how they were followed through. And so it really all came back to the same thing, which was safety.
And then how did you decide your bargaining priorities, like with your members?
You know, that is a great question. So both of us are actually pretty new. But we were both cognizant, aware that bargaining began in February. But it's just one of those things where we had heard bargaining was happening and it was like, okay. So truthfully, I'm not sure how those priorities came about. I know our bargaining team did a lot of work up front to ask members and to get a feel from each building, like, what is it that you're struggling with the most? Or if you could improve something, what would it be? So it was definitely a collective decision where, you know, our president was vice president of our union at the time, did reach out and we had input on like what exactly we were hoping to accomplish from our new contract.
Yeah. As you're talking, I also remember, a year ago in the spring, well, I guess a year and a half ago in the spring, We did have a collective team looking at behavior in the middle schools in particular. So behavior and safety has been an issue, a hot button issue for us for a while. And trying to get people on the same page. And again, going back to the accountability and the systems in place, we had nice notebooks on the shelf, but actually running the programs.
Right.
And in those meetings, there were community members and board members and staff and team members classified from all the sections. And it was, I left those feeling very hopeful. And then it sort of falls flat when you come back into school in the fall. And it was like, okay, why did we even do that? So I think that it's been just a brewing issue for safety. And then it, how do we tackle those? So then it became more defined around class size, around PD, around prep time, around all those things that will, that's all connected to help the systems work.
Mm-hmm. So because this was such an issue for so long, what were some of the district's arguments for not granting these things you were asking for? It seems pretty straightforward.
Yeah, absolutely. It seems like it shouldn't have been a fight, right? Mm-hmm. Our best estimation of why they were so resistant is because of the accountability piece. It would have put in writing in a contract that there were steps that needed to happen. There were protections for teachers, and that we could file grievances if those weren't followed through with, which was not in the contract that, you know, we previously had. Yeah, we did not start the year of the contract, but the one that we had previously, I mean, there was nothing specific about what happens in the classroom if it's an unsafe environment for the teacher and the students. And so our best estimation is that it was quite easy to not be accountable as far as the district was concerned.
And financial, looking at it, it's always easy, it felt like, for them to push that up. Well, the state's not funding us, the company, you know, whatever. So sort of felt like, well, our hands are tied sort of thing. And we just didn't believe that.
That's a familiar argument. So how did you respond as a union to these arguments and excuses, and the bargaining team itself?
Yeah, well, I think our bargaining team did a lot of work to look at the finances of the district. I mean, obviously being a public entity, that's all public information. And so they, you know, went through it with a fine tooth comb and said, no, we do have, you know, to Sandy's point, we do have the money for this. This is absolutely something that we can financially handle so that the environment is safer for everyone involved, including teachers. And so that was one of the arguments that we pushed back on, was like, no, we do have the means by which to do this. And then I think just continuing to press and hold them accountable for this is the job that you, when you ran for this position, you know, speaking on the school board, this is what you signed up for, is to work with us, collaborate with us, and understand that we are experts in our field and we're saying we need this. So we need this.
Right. Well, audience, if you're just joining us, you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Labor Radio. Unlike corporate media, KBOO is commercial-free. We rely on you, the listeners, to function and to survive on the air as a community radio station. So please, if you are able, go over to kboo.fm/give to make a one-time donation, or better yet, become a monthly donor. So excited to have you two. I'm sure you are probably feeling a little exhausted after the last month of being on strike. But before we get to the strike, tell us about some of the things that you did to ramp up pressure on the district before actually going out on strike. What did you do to organize your members, do all the strike readiness kinds of things?
Yeah. Well, I would say Sandy and I were discussing, I'm sure you've heard the phrase, the Albany way. And that's just a phrase that kind of named the way that the union has bargained with the district for many, many years, which is trying to be collaborative to the point of not getting what we need because we don't want to step on toes. But it was also to look at it through a more positive light. I think there was a lot more collaboration. There was sitting at the table together, having food together, and just having school board members who understood what was happening in the schools and in the classroom and how to help. It was really a lot more, what's the word I'm looking for?
It was a lot more give and take. And we had, before the last 9 years, we had people that stayed over and over. And so it was, oh yeah, we talked about that last time. Let's do this, right? So there, it was a more of a give and take. Like they sat together around the table and it was just really more collaborative.
Mm-hmm. So we would say one of the first steps to ramping up this time around was that it was very much our bargaining team sat at one table facing the other table, which had all of the district's bargaining team. And so it was very much, this is our side and that is your side, and we are not sitting together, which was a big difference from how we were bargaining in the past. But more specifically, it started with wearing our red on Thursdays to show unity and support for our union. And then we packed the room, which is, you know, we would have open bargaining sessions and we would call on as many members as possible who could come. And we would pack that room with educators wearing red and saying, hey, we're listening and we're paying attention to this process and we are going to hold you accountable for things that you say. That's how the ramp up began before we reached the decision to go on strike.
Yeah. All right. So now tell us, what was it like to be on strike? Talk about maybe that first day, what you remember about that first day, how that felt. And then I'd be curious to hear about what was a typical day like for you, any particular highlights or low points.
Well, Sandy and I both held different roles throughout the duration of the strike. To your previous question, one of the things that we did to organize was they established CAT members. CAT, it stands for Contract Action Team. And so these individuals were at each school and were meant to disseminate information to the members quickly and efficiently so that we were all on board and understood all the information that was coming in. Moving into the strike, my role was called a CAT lead. And really all that was is I was with an OEA staffer the whole day, helping make decisions and move the strike along and kind of keep a pulse on our picket lines and a pulse on, are we going to hold or not, essentially, is what my role, one of my roles was. Mm-hmm. So my day started at 6:30 in the morning, which, as we previously discussed, not being a morning person, that was something else, I'll tell you that. And my last meeting ending at 6:30 p.m. So they were definitely long days. And that first day being probably the most overwhelming of them all, in the sense of like having really no clue what I'm supposed to be doing and just trying to stay flexible throughout the day and almost drinking through a fire hose trying to figure out what exactly we're doing here.
Yeah.
Yeah. So my role, I was just the lead at the special programs department in our building. We also house one of our high needs classroom programs there too. So gathering those people, trying to get the information and trying to find who I connect with and then how to give that information out. So my day wasn't nearly as long, but it was longer than people that were on the line. So my day also would start at about 6:30 because the phone would start beeping with stuff. And preparing, and we'd be at our strike place in the morning. We'd have an action in the morning at our buildings. Then I'd go to a meeting, and then everybody else kind of had time for lunch, and then we'd have an afternoon action, and then there would be more follow-up from the CAT leads would come in, and so I'd be listening to that and sending out information to my team about what the plan was for the next day and making sure we did this, that, or the other. So they would send us in the morning. We had a runner go get our packets and our check-in things and kind of the topic that they wanted us to address and talk about. So we'd have a huddle in the morning to gather everybody at your building site. And then it just flowed through from there. And then we'd changed the activities in the afternoon. But so the mornings we were at each at our building sites. So we were striking and picketing at 21 sites. Well, 22 because Fairmount.
Mm-hmm.
And then the afternoon was everybody together somewhere.
Yeah. And a particular, any particular high point? I originally asked high point or low point. I'm mostly interested in high
absolutely. High point.
Something that kind of stood out for you that what you were doing was pretty important.
Mm-hmm. I would say one of the high points for me was seeing the community come together in a way that I was not expecting. Obviously not because I felt our community wasn't capable of it, but I'm fairly new to this community. I've only lived in Albany about 2.5 years, and this is my, you know, fourth year at GAPS. So seeing the community support and the community rallying behind us, not only was it touching, but it was, I think, absolutely essential to our success. I personally feel we would not have been able to hold the line for 13 days without the community behind us. So that was definitely a high point for me.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Having not had to be at this level of intensity my whole career, my kids' careers through the district, and just really not knowing. We had small turnout to some of our elections. We have small turnout to things. And so it was really astounding and just inspiring how much the community came. Like, they organized some weekend rallies and they did some other things to really be behind us.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a chance to come down for the rally that was on a weekend right before you went on strike. Mm-hmm. And I could sense the community support there, people driving by and honking their horns. And yeah, I could tell that there was some excitement there. And then my last question is, one thing I was impressed about with y'all is once you reached a tentative agreement, my understanding is that you didn't just immediately call off the strike. You said, no, we're gonna vote on this first. Can you say anything more about that decision?
Yeah, I think throughout the whole process, it was really important to our bargaining team that we have a voice, that it wasn't just they are doing all of the bargaining and the paperwork and the language, and we are just out in the cold. It was absolutely a moving and dynamic machine, and we are part of that and part of the success of our union. And so that was something that we were not going to return to work until our membership was able to ratify the vote.
That is great. And I think that's an important end to any strike, is to have that member voice in there.
Yes, absolutely.
So how did you address any fears that members had about striking, and like post-strike, how are members feeling about it now that it's over? What are you hearing from your members, from family, students, things like that?
So I think one of the big things that we hit and we talked about and discovered, we're historically pretty silo-based, and just in our own buildings, in our own worlds. And this strike gave us the opportunity to talk with and meet people from different levels and hear the stories. And as we know, when you see people and you connect with people, you're more likely to band together and fight with rather than against. And so that interconnectedness was also one of the big highlights. But one of the things that, we hope really continues to carry on, and that awareness piece, so that we can continue. Now the work happens, right, as we heal and move forward and get back in and hold people accountable to our contract and things.
Mm-hmm.
And how about from members of the community, like families and students? Have you heard from them post-strike?
I would say, well, definitely parents. I would say the first day back was a very emotionally overwhelming. I do arrival duty at my school, and so stepping out and having a lot of parents like pat me on the back and saying, we're super proud of you, we're so glad you held that line, this is going to be so great for our community, thank you for all the work you did, that was really touching. And also made me feel like we had done something right. You know, our community backing us and continuing to support us was something that kind of was a, I guess, a guiding point for me to know that we had fought for the right things and that we held for the right things. My kiddos, obviously being elementary school, they just thought they got the coolest 3-week break just cause, you know, so they keep saying like, I missed the break. So it's really cute. So they, you know, I can't speak too much on students, unfortunately, since my kids are all little, but I can say that they were definitely excited to be back in school, seeing their teachers and their friends. That's for sure.
Yeah, the community has continued. They built a page. They're planning a party to celebrate right before the break, and they're keeping that alive out. Facebook and their social media stuff is still happening. I was on the line with one of my kids, and so that was an experience as well. Her first year in, so it was fun to be proud of her and watch that and see, and also people being really excited to get back in the building. So we had it was almost a slow start. There was if you know that we started our day back late start. So the teachers got 2 hours to get all their stuff back and get ready for class for students. But we had a lot of parents expressing in person and on the social media, like, that's crazy. My teacher needs more time than that. And so we had low attendance actually on Tuesday. So, mm-hmm. And then they start, then everybody was like, oh, and then we're full. So as I go around and do behavior stuff and touching all the buildings, that was pretty consistent across the board.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
But a lot of unity with classified staff and the people that kept working while we were out on the strike line, and new posters and new energy and, you know, a lot of together. So I have a lot of hope for where we're moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Great. So you had some significant wins as a result of your strike, and I'd love to hear about some of the things you mentioned on the front end of the interview, like class size, planning time, all those things that you won in your contract. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we originally were bargaining for class size caps K through 12. And then we're able to narrow it just based on how negotiations go, narrowed it down to thresholds for class sizes, primarily in elementary and secondary levels. But kinder is really where they're holding the line, which is awesome. And so the threshold or the class size cap in kindergarten, if it goes over that, then it triggers either hiring a new teacher and having students be separated out evenly so that the class size stays low, or if there's no room for another classroom, hiring a classified staff member to be a support aid teacher in that classroom as well. So that's super exciting. Another thing that we got, you mentioned, was the so we mentioned accountability and prevention for safety as well, and having that language in our contract was super important to us. And then having a seat at the table. What we mean by that is that there are several parts of our contract where union members must be present within the teams that are deciding how the safety is being met in classrooms, class size caps in classrooms, which is really exciting because that wasn't something that we were part of before, or if we were somewhere in the language, it just wasn't being followed through with. So we're excited to hold them accountable on that.
We also got a good compensation package, and which we have had a lot of turnover because we are the lowest in comparable districts of 35 in the state. And so we are teaching, we just can't get any traction. We don't have a lot of reason to come and stay. So we got a big improvement with that. Also,
that is excellent. And I love that your class size language is just this or this. There's no wiggle room to have to actually hire another adult to help support. That's great. so we do have to end in about a minute, but I just would love to see how you feel like, you kind of talked about this a little bit, but how the strike engaged your members and strengthened your union and your relationship to the community, what you feel like you learned from this experience. A lot to say in like 30 seconds each, but.
I know, I'll make it snappy. I would say for me personally, understanding what a union actually is and what it means, having a deep understanding of how each and every one of us is important to moving this community forward was very eye-opening and something that I will definitely not soon forget. And understanding that the work continues, it's not over. You know, there are several individuals, or not several, I would say a few individuals definitely feel like we didn't get everything we could, but it gives me a lot of hope to know that this is not a one-stop train. We will continue the work. Our community is engaged now. They understand what needs to happen so that the work can be productive moving forward. And I think that's super exciting.
Yeah, I think too, just the coming together. So our classified union, our union, with administration and the community, all learning and moving and getting on the same page a little bit more. So
looking forward. Excellent. Thank you both so much for joining us on KBOO. Thanks to Jamie Partridge for helping us convert this to a radio-ready file. Thank you, audience, for tuning in tonight. Thank you, Stephen. This is Rachel Haynes. You've been listening to Labor Radio. Tune in next Monday and every Monday at 6 p.m. to catch another Labor Radio show.
Nothing.
Tune in to KBOO for Drinking from Puddles.